This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Ron Rash is the author of five critically acclaimed books, including Serena and The World Made Straight. For his sixth novel, he wanted something more hopeful, so he wrote about the relationship between a sheriff and a park ranger with the backdrop of a mysterious crime. His latest book, Above the Waterfall, is set in Appalachia, and as is the case with so many of Ron's writings, the landscape is a character unto itself. Ron Rash teaches at Western Carolina University. He's going to read from Above the Waterfall on Monday at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, then on Tuesday at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. But first, he's on The State of Things with me, Ron Rash. Good to have you back.
Good to be back.
Well, more hopeful, but less in Becky, your sheriff and ranger are in quite a bind. You get them involved in quite a mess here. So it's tell us about this book.
Well, it's a book that, as we've talked about, I wanted it to be a book about a more hopeful book, a book about wonder and the need for wonder, and two people who have had traumatic experiences early in their lives. Becky has survived a school shooting, actually saw her teacher killed, and Les has almost caused his ex-wife to commit suicide. So these two people have had very traumatic situations, and yet in the book it's about them attempting to find a way to heal themselves.
Through the natural world and the wonder of the natural world, and the particular natural world that occurs in Appalachia, once again, a character in the book, would you say?
Definitely, yeah, a major character.
Will you read for us?
Sure. I thought I'd start with the opening, and Becky's voice was probably the most challenging aspect of the book for me, but it's also the most enjoyable to do because I wanted to try to bring as much as I know about poetry into her voice, because she actually has found that if she can intensely see the world, she can. She feels like that connection is what helps her to survive and live in the world. So this is a scene right at dusk in the mountains of North Carolina, and she's describing a field of black-eyed Susans. Though sunlight tinges the mountains, black leather-winged bodies swing low. First fireflies blink languidly. Beyond this meadow, cicadas rev and slow like sewing machines, all else ready for night except night itself. I watch last light lift off level land. Ground shadows seep and thicken. Circling trees form banks. The meadow itself becomes a pond filling. On its surface, dozens of black-eyed Susans. I sit on ground cooling, soon dew damp. Near me, a moldboard plow long left. Honeysuckle vines twine green cords, white flowers attached like Christmas lights. I touch a handle slick from wrist shifts and sweaty grips. Memory of my grandfather's hands, calluses round and smooth as worn coins. One morning I'd watched him cross the field, the steel ore rippling soil. In its wake, a caught wave of sillion shine. But this plow has wearied into sleep. How long lying here? Perhaps a decade since saplings and sawbriar rise amid broom sedge. Above all else, those bold yellow blossoms in full petaled bloom. What has brought me here? A deer emerges from the woods, nose up, stilt step, then steadying paws, another hoof lifted. Dark rises around me. The black-eyed Susans float like water lilies. All else disappears, but they hold their yellow glow. Moon mirrors, sun ghost, dream abeyant. When the night pond floods its banks, I walk the trail to the state park truck. Maybe another time, Les had answered when I invited him, claiming sheriff business to attend to. The trail steepens. When I look back at the meadow, only darkness.
Ron Rash reading from his latest novel, Above the Waterfall. Highly poetic, Ron. And is this something, you know, you talked about finding it most difficult to capture her voice. Did you? Is that a voice that you've heard? Is that the kind of language you hear, or did you really have to sort of impose something on Becky?
I had to impose, or in a sense, create. I think because I wanted her voice to be really distinctive and, in a way, idiosyncratic to a degree. She's been very influenced by the poetry of Gerard Manley Hopkins, so she's very interested in sounds, how sounds play off against one another, and rhythms. And I just felt like that kind of intense language would fit the intensity in which she feels nature.
It's a scary prospect. It works so well because it's consistent and it doesn't stand out. It doesn't somehow feel like an aberration. It's a very consistent, plausible voice, and yet it is stylized. Were you worried in the process that this might end up sounding, you know, sort of contrived?
Well, that's the risk I think a writer takes when he or she tries to, you know, introduce a voice this radical. But I felt by having the sheriff's sections alternate that it wouldn't, in a sense, get to the point where the reader might say, okay, I can go read a book of poems if I want this. And I kept her short. You know, all of her sections are very short. But I felt that matched the intensity of her.
Yeah. Yeah, it works very well. Now, the other problem that a writer, especially who's going to write about Appalachia, can have to contend with is sort of staying away from stereotypes, and you've always managed to do that. Is that a challenge for you, sort of not falling into that little pit?
Well, I think because, you know, of my living there and my family living there for a couple hundred years, that I know the people, and I think that's where I am aware of that, and there is a danger there, but I feel like if whatever happens with my characters, because I have characters sometimes who do terrible things, I have characters who do wonderful things, but if the reader does not see them as human beings, then I've failed. I mean, if they see them as deliverance types, mm-hmm. I've failed. But if I romanticize them, I failed too, because either way, you're denying their humanity. So my goal is that though they speak differently, their situations are very different. Nevertheless, I hope the reader will recognize these are human beings doing the best with the hands life has dealt them.
You have given us two characters who, in very different ways, are suffering from forms of guilt. One, in the sheriff's case, when, you know, he might consider himself responsible. In Becky's case, the sort of survivor guilt that one might feel from having gotten out alive. And again, against this backdrop of a sort of immutable nature, the thing that you, whatever your conscience tells you, is going to go on its own, with or without you. that way of playing one against the other, the stuff that goes on inside our heads versus the nature around us, works, I think, powerfully well. Was that intentional for you? Or is that something I'm just reading in the clouds here, Ron?
No. I wanted that kind of reaction. I mean, you know, as I say, this is a book where there's an intensity level, particularly with Becky, and that connection with the natural world that I'm trying to get as close as possible within that voice. In a way, you know, in a sense, her obsession is to come as close to word and world being one thing. Mm.
Also, some intimate relationships with your characters. I wonder if you can read another section that I think gives us a pretty good glimpse into that as well.
Right. This is a scene where Les goes to Becky's cabin. And as I say, both of them are very gun-shy, so they start this relationship. And this is the first time he's seen the inside of her house or cabin. And also, we're getting a sense of how their relationship is going or not going, at least at this part of the book. 2 years, and I still didn't know what word to use for our relationship. A few dates, a few kisses, but more than anything, a wary, out-of-step dance. Except for the first time I'd been in Becky's cabin. On that evening, it had almost been more. I'd brought a bottle of wine, and as Becky got us glasses, I'd sat on the couch and surveyed the cabin's front room, curious to see what it might reveal about her. There was a shelf of books, most connected to nature, but also some poetry and art books, including one I'd borrowed about the cave art in Lascaux. On the fireboard was a crumbling hornet's nest, a gold pocket watch, and a single photograph. In one corner, a butter churn, in another corner, a table, a chair, and a lamp. Except for the couch, that was it. No TV or CD player, no clock or radio or computer, no rug. Nothing on the walls, not even a calendar. The photograph of two old people, sun-streaked in an oval frame, seemed, like the rest of the room's contents, remnants left in a house long abandoned. That night, for the first time, our kisses were the kind that led to a bed. But our talk was even more intimate, as if the room's feeling of time turned back allowed us to speak more freely of our past. Becky talked about her time with Richard Pelfrey, and I told her about my ex-wife, Sarah, sharing things I'd never told anyone. Becky had also talked about her childhood, the shooting at the elementary school, and what had happened in the months afterward. We spoke of promises. But with the late hour and empty wine bottle came the feeling that we'd revealed too much, violated something within ourselves, the very thing that had attracted us to each other in the first place. So we'd left it there for 6 months. More than once I'd imagined a listing on an internet dating site. Man who encouraged clinically depressed wife to kill herself seeks woman traumatized by school shooting who later lived with eco-terrorist bomber.
Ron Rash reading Above the Waterfall, or reading from his latest novel. Ron, when you conceptualize your book, do they come to you the same way? Do you start out with a story, a plot? Is it a theme? How do your novels come to you?
They always start with an image. And every novel I've written, a single image that I cannot get out of my head. And in this particular novel, it was the image of a dead trout in a stream. I knew they'd been poisoned, and I knew that something had happened that was going to involve probably a sheriff, but also a park ranger. And I'd had this image of a park ranger in my head for several years, a female park ranger. And so this was, in a sense, I think I was preparing for Becky, and I finally found the story that would fit her. But yeah, every novel, you know, Serena started off with an image of a woman on horseback, and they start there, and I don't know where I'm going, and mm-hmm. That's rather frightening, because usually after about a year I get completely lost, and it seems like it's going to be hopeless, but then I just have to keep believing in that image and trying and trying, and eventually I find my way.
Is it the sort of thing where you see the dead trout and then you work back kind of point by point from that, you know, how did that dead trout get there point by point, or do you take great leaps in time and space and have sort of multiple images that you then have to connect over the writing process?
Yeah, I think it's more of the latter. I knew, obviously, the dead trout would bring certain people into this story, but I wasn't sure what had happened or who would be involved. But then it's almost like there used to be these old Polaroid photographs that would just slowly develop. And sometimes it feels like that. But I'd been working on this book 2 years, and Becky's voice wasn't in it. And that was what was missing. I knew something was wrong. And so I spent most of the last year just developing her voice and trying to make it as distinctive as possible.
You talked about those dark moments when you get, you know, a year into it or something, and you think, oh, where am I now? I can't. How do I fight my way out of this? Have you ever had to just drop it? And if so, have you ever sort of extracted parts of the abandoned projects and have they found their way into other books?
Well, I tend to cannibalize my own work. So sometimes when something's not working in prose, I'll try a poem. Sometimes I'll write a poem and realize I've got more there, and it'll develop into fiction. So sometimes I just really don't know if it's going to be a short story or a novel. Sometimes even if it's going to be a poem, sometimes it evolves from being a poem to a short story to a novel.
Well, you teach writing, and I wonder if that has any influence on your own writing.
It does. It keeps me aware of some of the pitfalls that I see in my students' work and some of the strengths. And I think it makes me more aware of certain tendencies that I might have as well. So I feel like I learn from my students as much as I give them.
Your books have won critical acclaim. You've also been on the bestseller list a number of times. Does that place pressure on you with each subsequent novel?
Not really. I think my goal whenever I write a book is that I've done the best I can with this particular book. And some books are going to be better than others. You know, it's not like everyone's going to get better. But if I feel like I've done my best and it's a book I feel good about, then there's nothing else I can do. You know, I've given it my best shot. And if it falls short, then so be it.
And then that's the critics' fault, if you ask me.
Well, no. Now, sometimes they're probably very right, but I tend not to read reviews. That's not a healthy thing for a writer.
Well, then I assume you have editors, but what other kind of critical, sort of views do you take with your work to get some kind of outside look at what you're doing?
Well, my brother's a very good reader, and usually before I show it to my editor, I go through. He's in a sense my first editor, and brothers don't have to be nice.
And in fact, so they're famous for not being nice.
Yeah,
that's what
right.
Makes them brothers.
And he's very he can be very tough on me, but that's what I want, and honest. Yeah. And he knows when I'm getting lazy. But probably the most important thing, he knows me and my work so well that he knows not only what's on the page, but what I'm trying to do. And I think that's the really valuable aspect of it.
Has your writing process evolved, would you say? And if so, how?
Well, I think I really broke through once I quit trying to outline or know the whole story. And I think that was probably the most critical decision I made when I was when I started working on novels, where I just felt comfortable enough to risk being lost and not knowing where it was going.
There's a lot of suspense built into this novel, and that is a real, that to me is a craft point. Is that something that you feel you get better at? Do you have to sort of learn how to do that kind of plotting when you want to manage suspense that way?
I think you do. And I think that's where it's so valuable to read other writers. And and I learn from other writers, because it's always that question. You want to give enough information to keep the reader interested, but at the same time, you don't want to give away too much. And so, in a way, it's almost like a dance with the reader. You're taking one move and getting them, and then taking them another, and you hope you'll build enough suspense to get them to follow you all the way. But also that they begin to care about the characters, and that's a huge part of it too. Getting the reader to admire the characters, or not necessarily admire them, but be drawn to them.
It seems to me that's two different kinds of processes that go on in your head. One is sort of following these images and letting them lead you and then writing your way out of that. And another is this kind of really crafty way of saying, oh, no, wait, can't give them all that now. I've got to hold that till the next chapter or something. Can one be kind of an escape for another? In other words, you've written yourself into a hole. I don't know how to get out of this. And you think, well, let's go back to the craft here. Let's just try to be a craftsman here and break the block. Or is that not a kind of alternation that you that helps you in any way?
No, it does. I mean, and sometimes when I'm stuck, I'll go back and read a novel by a writer I admire who has some, you know, similar technical situations to work with. You know, for instance, backstory as opposed to current, and that sometimes is helpful, just seeing how other writers have done it. But eventually, you have to find a way to make it work in this particular book, and it's always going to be a little bit different than in any other book, how the pacing and those questions of balance and rhythm. And one thing I hoped for in this book was the rhythm between Les's voice and Becky's.
Ron Rash, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ron Rash is the author of Above the Waterfall. He's going to be reading at Quail Ridge Books on Monday, then at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Tuesday. And you can get all the information on those readings and more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a Duke theologian looks at the daily rituals that brought her closer to God. Stay tuned.